In a world where dreams often fade with childhood, one man refused to let his imagination dim. Walt Disney. The name conjures images of animated mice, fairy tale castles, and theme parks where happiness reigns. Yet behind this empire of enchantment stood a man whose life story is perhaps more compelling than any tale he brought to screen. His journey from a struggling cartoonist to creating a global entertainment phenomenon wasn't just luck or genius, it was the result of specific qualities that anyone might cultivate. What made Walt different wasn't just his creativity, but his resilience in the face of repeated failures, his unwavering optimism when others saw only obstacles, and his ability to inspire loyalty in those around him. Beloved by presidents and children alike, Walt's influence extends far beyond entertainment. He fundamentally changed how we experience storytelling, reimagined what family entertainment could be, and created a cultural touchstone that continues to evolve decades after his passing. His story isn't just about animation or theme parks, it's about the power of perseverance, imagination, and believing that anything is possible. Walt Disney's journey began in humble circumstances that would profoundly shape his creative vision. Born in 1901 to strict Congregationalist Elias Disney and his more nurturing wife Flora, young Walt experienced a childhood of stark contrasts. His father was a stern disciplinarian who physically punished his children and dismissed artistic pursuits as wasteful. Yet from this seemingly harsh upbringing, Walt gained invaluable traits. Integrity, work ethic, perseverance, and compassion. From his mother, he inherited a love of reading, humor, and an optimistic outlook that would become his trademark. The family's move to a farm near Marceline, Missouri in 1906 marked a pivotal chapter in Walt's development. Here, amid rolling countryside and small-town America, Walt's imagination flourished. He treated farm animals as friends, created stories about them, and discovered his passion for drawing when a neighboring doctor commissioned a horse sketch from the young boy. In Marceline, Walt also experienced his first theatrical play, Peter Pan, and motion picture, about Christ's resurrection, formative encounters with storytelling mediums he would later revolutionize. When financial difficulties forced the family to relocate to Kansas City in 1909, Walt and his brother Roy endured harsh conditions delivering newspapers in blizzards and extreme temperatures. Despite being an unremarkable student who often fell asleep in class, Walt's creative talents emerged as he formed the Two Walts with friend Walter Pfeiffer, performing comedy skits at amateur night contests. These experiences developed the facial expressions, gestures, and comedic timing he would later use to bring cartoon characters to life. Two Kansas City amusement parks, particularly Electric Park, with its nightly transformation into a magical fairyland of 100,000 illuminated bulbs, planted seeds that would later bloom into Disneyland. At 14, Walt fell in love with Snow White after seeing a silent movie version. Never imagining he would one day create the definitive adaptation of the fairy tale. The most remarkable aspect of Walt's early life wasn't the hardships themselves, but his response to them. Despite experiencing treatment from his father that would be considered abusive by today's standards, Walt chose to focus on positive memories while letting go of the painful ones. He shaped his identity around warm, nostalgic recollections of Marceline, the romance of the railroad, and the thrill of his first circus parade. This ability to maintain unfailing optimism despite setbacks became central to his success and personal happiness. As Ray Bradbury later noted, everything Walt achieved in his life was something he was told he couldn't do. The lesson from Walt's early life is clear. Accept the pain of the past, learn its lessons, embrace nostalgic memories, then dream big dreams and chase them with unwavering determination. Walt's unshakable belief that anything is possible faced its ultimate test in 1928 when disaster struck his fledgling animation career. After losing his star character Oswald the Lucky Rabbit and most of his animation staff to distributor Charles Mintz, many would have given up. Instead, during the train ride home from New York to Los Angeles, Walt began sketching a new character, a spunky little mouse that would change entertainment history. This wasn't Walt's first experience with adversity. After returning from World War I service with the Red Cross Ambulance Corps, he had already weathered multiple setbacks. Rejected by the Kansas City Star, he pivoted to commercial art, forming a partnership with Yub Iwerks. When their Laugh-O-Gram films faced bankruptcy in 1923, Walt boarded a train to California with just $40, a suitcase, and a film reel, ready to start anew at age 21. What distinguished Walt throughout these early struggles was his remarkable salesmanship. He convinced Al Carter to provide free office space in exchange for artwork, persuaded investors to fund his ventures, and sold unfinished cartoons to distributors. His brother Roy recognized this gift, noting that Walt could sell anything to anyone. This salesmanship wasn't based on slick talking, but on absolute honesty and infectious enthusiasm that made others believe in his vision. When Walt lost Oswald, his response wasn't anger, but creative reinvention. Rather than dwelling on the betrayal, he sent Roy an optimistic telegram. "Don't worry, everything okay. We'll give details when arrive." This positive attitude wasn't just a front. Walt genuinely believed in his ability to overcome any obstacle. Mickey Mouse emerged from this crisis as a character infused with Walt's own personality, optimistic, adventurous, and resilient. After initial rejections from distributors who saw Mickey as just Oswald with round ears, Walt made another bold decision. Mickey needed to talk. Steamboat Willie, the first synchronized sound cartoon, premiered on November 18, 1928, to a standing ovation. Mickey Mouse Club soon exceeded 1 million members, and the character became Walt's alter ego, his battles against Pegleg Pete symbolizing Walt's triumphs over adversity. Walt's approach to creativity was equally revolutionary. He didn't view imagination as merely an innate talent, but as a learnable skill. He constantly generated ideas, saw possibilities others missed, and transformed everyday experiences into magical moments. His method involved drawing on life experiences for inspiration, removing self-imposed limits, generating multiple solutions to every problem, silencing his inner critic, and maintaining childlike wonder. Most importantly, Walt had the courage to pursue bold ideas and the work ethic to transform dreams into reality. When faced with setbacks like losing Oswald, his response wasn't anger, but creative reinvention, turning crisis into opportunity and forever changing the landscape of American entertainment. The early success of Mickey Mouse revealed Walt Disney as not just a creative genius, but a transformative leader who would reinvent how creative organizations function. His leadership style combined visionary thinking with practical management skills, though not without growing pains along the way. After Steamboat Willie's success, Walt signed with distributor Patrick Powers to preserve his creative independence, despite Roy's objections to the unfavorable contract terms. When Powers began withholding royalties and hired away Yub Iwerks, Walt's longtime friend and chief animator, Walt faced a painful betrayal. Yet rather than compromising his vision, Walt walked away and found new distribution through Columbia Pictures. The stress of running the studio while battling difficult distributors took a severe toll. In 1931, Walt went all to pieces and was hospitalized with throat problems, requiring a rejuvenating vacation with Lillian. Upon his return, Walt pushed animation forward with innovations like Technicolor in Flowers and Trees and personality animation in Three Little Pigs, which became an anthem of hope during the Depression. These early challenges taught Walt valuable leadership lessons. He learned he wasn't as good at judging people as he thought, began relying on Roy's business judgment, and recognized his own strengths and weaknesses. While Walt excelled as an entrepreneur and visionary, he acknowledged Roy's superior management skills. Together, the Disney brothers formed one of American business history's most successful partnerships. What made Walt an exceptional leader was his combination of seven essential qualities: vision, communication skills, people skills, good character, competence, boldness, and a servant's heart. His extraordinary vision transformed primitive cartoons into colorful, sound-filled experiences with characters audiences genuinely cared about. Though not a polished orator, Walt communicated with simple directness that captivated listeners, often climbing on furniture or getting on the floor to illustrate points. Walt's people skills included exceptional delegation, managing results rather than processes, inspiring loyalty, creating informality, and building effective teams. He insisted everyone call him by his first name and deliberately dressed casually to put people at ease. The studio operated as a community of relationships rather than a rigid hierarchy, with Walt encouraging honest opinions while testing people to see who would stand by their convictions. Despite his admirable character, Walt had a notable flaw, his harsh temperament. He could be gruff and insensitive, sometimes publicly reprimanding staff. Animator Jack Cutting described Walt's personality as a drop of mercury rolling around on a slab of marble, due to his quickly changing moods. Yet his staff remained loyal for decades because, as Paul Carlson explained, they loved him because they knew he was pulling for them. Walt demonstrated his competence through a strong track record of successes, commitment to hard work, often sleeping in his office, continual personal growth despite only completing ninth grade, fierce competitive spirit, and unwavering commitment to excellence. His boldness was evident in his willingness to repeatedly bet his entire studio on single projects, trusting his instincts without needing focus groups or boards of directors. Perhaps most distinctively, Walt embodied servant leadership in countless ways. Personally taking care of injured friends, paying for an employee's wedding reception, providing accommodations for disabled staff, establishing scholarship funds, and consistently putting others' needs before his own. This servant's heart is what truly distinguished Walt as a leader rather than a boss, inspiring extraordinary loyalty and creativity from his team. In 1934, despite having a comfortable home, successful studio, and shelf full of Oscars, Walt Disney risked everything on a seemingly impossible dream that others called Disney's folly. Against the advice of both his wife and brother, Walt committed to creating the first feature-length animated film, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, gambling his entire studio on a fairy tale that many believed audiences would never sit through. Walt had considered making feature-length films since 1931, initially planning a live-action animation hybrid of Alice in Wonderland with Mary Pickford. When that project fell through, he drew inspiration from childhood favorites like Snow White. The 32-year-old Walt decided in spring 1934 to bet his entire studio on his vision, despite everyone saying it was crazy. Initially keeping his plan secret, Walt developed the story alone before revealing it to Lillian and Roy. Both were alarmed. Lily worried about risking their successful studio, while Roy calculated the budget would be at least $500,000, double Walt's estimate. When Walt gathered 40 top animators, he didn't just tell them the story, he performed it, becoming each character through voice and expression. His passionate performance so energized his team that they believed the impossible was not only possible, but practically accomplished. The production immediately faced challenges. When The Goddess of Spring, a test cartoon featuring human figures, proved a dismal failure with rubbery, unrealistic animation, Walt launched an intensive $100,000 annual art training program. He brought in instructors from the Schweinart Art Institute for night classes and invited leading artists like Frank Lloyd Wright to lecture. Walt carefully developed distinct personalities for the Seven Dwarfs, choosing names from over 50 options, and meticulously cast voices, including 19-year-old Adriana Caselotti as Snow White. Walt's commitment to excellence drove costs ever higher. He ruthlessly cut completed sequences that interrupted story flow, including Ward Kimball's beautiful 4-minute Music in Your Soup sequence. Walt also invested in revolutionary technologies like the multiplane camera, first showcased in the Oscar-winning short The Old Mill, and ordered entire completed sections of Snow White redone to incorporate this innovation, despite Roy's financial concerns. Hollywood pundits called the half-million-dollar project Disney's folly, predicting financial ruin. By summer 1937, with Snow White's release approaching, the Disneys had exhausted all funds, with production costs exceeding $1 million, more than any live-action film of the time, and needing another $500,000 to finish. At Roy's insistence, Walt reluctantly showed Bank of America's Joe Rosenberg a rough cut cobbled from finished color sequences and crude pencil tests. Despite Walt's embarrassment over the incomplete film, Rosenberg declared, "That movie is going to make a hatful of money. You'll get your loan," saving the studio from bankruptcy. The completed Snow White employed over 750 animation craftsmen, with only 250,000 of 2 million drawings making it to screen. After a test screening in Pomona, the film premiered December 21, 1937 at the Carthay Circle Theater. Hollywood's biggest stars attended the gala event, where the audience gave spontaneous applause throughout and a standing ovation at the end. The film earned $8.5 million in its initial release, paid off all studio debts, and funded construction of the new $3.8 million Burbank studio. Walt's greatest genius was his boldness in betting everything on Snow White. Taking risks meant making bold decisions, even with incomplete information. Walt believed delaying decisions was more dangerous than acting with partial facts. His early failures taught him he could survive setbacks, making him invulnerable to fear. Yet Walt wasn't reckless. His risks were calculated. As his grandson Chris Miller said, he risked everything he had to make his dreams come true, and he persevered until he achieved them. Snow White's astounding success briefly gave Walt a fairy tale happily ever after moment, but tragedy and loss would soon invade his life. In November 1938, at the height of Walt's success, his mother Flora died from a gas leak in the home Walt and Roy had purchased for their parents. Walt was devastated and blamed himself, telling one secretary who inquired, "I don't want that ever mentioned in this office again." If anything positive came from this tragedy, it was Walt making more time for his wife and children, perhaps newly aware of life's brevity. Professional challenges quickly followed personal loss. After 3 years and $2.6 million, Pinocchio premiered in February 1940. Though artistically brilliant, it flopped commercially because Hitler's invasion of Poland had closed European markets. The financial failure, combined with simultaneous production of Fantasia and Bambi, plus the expense of the new Burbank studio, forced Walt and Roy to take their company public, raising $3 million. Fantasia, Walt's most ambitious feature yet, premiered on November 13, 1940. The project began as a simple Mickey Mouse short, but expanded after a chance meeting with conductor Leopold Stokowski. Despite its artistic achievements, Fantasia failed at the box office. When receiving the Irving G. Thalberg Memorial Award in 1942, Walt admitted, "We all make mistakes. Fantasia was a mistake, but an honest one." Animator Frank Thomas noted, "I think the failure of Fantasia hurt Walt because it kept him from experimenting." Walt concluded his studio couldn't survive another failed experiment. From now on, his films would need mass appeal. By early 1941, Disney faced financial trouble and labor unrest. Walt believed he had created a workers' paradise at the Burbank studio, with custom workspaces, subsidized food, recreational facilities, and no production quotas. When layoffs occurred due to financial pressures, frightened workers joined the Screen Cartoonists Guild. Walt made a critical error in May 1941 by firing Art Babbitt and having him escorted off the property, unaware this violated federal labor law. The next morning, about 300 employees, half his artists, were picketing. Walt was shocked to see top animators like Bill Tytla on the line. The strike continued through summer, with picketers' ranks swelling to over 1,000. Despite pressure from Bank of America to settle, Walt refused, viewing the strike as the work of leftist agitators. The strike ended September 14th with binding arbitration and union victory. This period marked the third workforce defection that deeply hurt Walt. The golden age of Mickey Mouse and Snow White was over, never to return. Before the strike, Nelson Rockefeller had approached Walt about making a goodwill tour to South America to counter growing Nazi influence. With Roy's encouragement, Walt departed for Brazil on August 11, 1941, bringing along non-striking artists. The Disney team immersed themselves in Latin American culture, speaking with locals, comparing styles with Latin artists, attending performances, and exploring natural wonders. The tour produced two feature films, Saludos Amigos, 1943, and The Three Caballeros, 1945. While Walt was away, Roy agreed to binding arbitration, ending the strike. Walt returned for Dumbo's premiere on October 23, 1941, facing both the strike's disappointing outcome and the news that his father Elias had died at age 81 while Walt was abroad, a painful personal loss, as Walt never received the approval and affirmation he'd sought from his father. When facing such losses, Walt demonstrated remarkable resilience. He learned to let go of needing to know why, forgive himself for circumstances beyond his control, look for meaning in pain, be patient with grief, and accept what cannot be changed. These qualities would serve him well in the challenging war years ahead, as his studio pivoted to producing propaganda films and training videos for the government while struggling to stay afloat financially. In October 1941, with Dumbo's New York premiere, Walt faced the challenge of producing quality films on reduced budgets as Hitler's war machine had cut off important income sources. Dumbo would be his answer to this challenge, a film that took less than a year to animate at a cost of only $812,000, yet grossed over $2.5 million on its first release. Walt's commitment to excellence and giving customers more than expected defined his approach. He called it plussing, improving everything beyond what was necessary or expected. After Pearl Harbor, the Disney studio was transformed. The Army commandeered parts of the facility, filling a machine shed with ammunition and turning a soundstage into a repair shop. Walt committed his studio to producing films for the government at cost, refusing to take a profit despite government bookkeepers' confusion. Though Walt lost one-third of his animators to the draft, the studio's output increased 1,000%, producing patriotic cartoons, anti-Nazi propaganda, and even designing combat insignia for military units free of charge. Walt pressed ahead with Bambi, a masterpiece of animated realism that took 9 years, 4 million drawings, and $1.75 million to create. The film featured natural grace and believability from studying live animals and ethereal backgrounds by Chinese-born artist Tyrus Wong. Despite audience gasps at the death of Bambi's mother, a scene Walt refused to change despite protests, the film initially lost money, earning $1 million less than production costs. Only after the war did audiences recognize its significance. Walt coined the term plussing in the 1940s, using plus as a verb meaning to improve something beyond expectations. He plussed Mickey with sound, silly symphonies with color, and sent artists to school at his expense. Sometimes plussing meant subtracting elements that slowed the action. Walt's battles with Roy over expenses became legendary, with Walt insisting, "Roy, we'll make the pictures, you get the money." At Disneyland, Walt would tip cast members who created magical memories, saying, "Disneyland will never be finished. It will be a living, breathing thing that will always be changing." As Walt prepared for Cinderella in the post-war 1940s, he honed his artist's skills with package features like Make Mine Music and Fun and Fancy Free. The financial strain intensified conflicts between the brothers. Roy, frustrated by Walt's insistence on plussing at the expense of profits, Walt believing Roy's cost-conscious approach was short-sighted. When Roy finally convinced Walt to attend a stockholder meeting, Walt read a supportive letter from a shareholder who didn't care about dividends, told the stunned businessman, "He understands what Disney is all about," and walked out. Roy never invited Walt to another stockholder meeting. In 1950, Cinderella marked a profitable return to fairy tales that audiences loved. Walt chose Charles Perrault's version over the Brothers Grimm's, then plussed it with memorable characters like Jack and Gus the Mice, and transformed the witch into a sweet fairy godmother. Lucille Bliss, who voiced stepsister Anastasia, remembered Walt's personal involvement and encouragement of ad-libbing. His personal involvement made us all try harder. Walt's adaptation of Peter Pan exemplifies his commitment to plussing. Released February 5, 1953, at a cost of $4 million, the film earned over $88 million in theatrical releases alone. Animator Frank Thomas recalled Walt proudly sharing a story from England where he overheard two women discussing the film. One worried it was terribly Americanized, but the other admitted, "When you see it, you don't mind that so much." Validation that delighted Walt. When accountants suggested skipping Disneyland's expensive Christmas parade since nobody's expecting it, Walt replied, "That's just the point. We should do the parade precisely because no one's expecting it. Our goal at Disneyland is to always give the people more than they expect." He demanded perfection in even the smallest details, ordering immediate repair of chipped paint, telling matte artist Peter Ellenshaw to never compromise quality for deadlines, and ensuring the Pirates of the Caribbean's lifelike figures were flawless despite guests passing quickly. The lesson? Excellence and attention to detail turn clients into fans and create experiences that endure. Walt's dream of creating a magical park began in his youth at Electric Park in Kansas City and crystallized at Griffith Park, where he watched his daughters on the merry-go-round, believing parents and children should have fun together. When Walt shared his Mickey Mouse Park concept with Roy, he faced resistance, but proceeded using personal funds to develop plans for a village green, carnival rides, and a western town connected by a miniature steam train. In 1949, Walt built the Carowood Pacific Railroad at his new Holmby Hills home, creating a working 1/8 scale steam locomotive with help from studio machinist Roger Broggi and carpenter Ray Fox. This half-mile track became Walt's creative sanctuary, where he would later develop Disneyland plans. While researching his park concept, Walt faced skepticism from amusement park operators who doubted his vision of a clean park with admission charges and friendly staff. Undeterred, he found inspiration at Copenhagen's Tivoli Gardens, whose cleanliness and family atmosphere aligned with his vision of creating a World's Fair of Delights. Initial funding came from unexpected sources, including studio nurse Hazel George and other employees through Disneyland backers and boosters. Eventually, ABC invested $500,000 and guaranteed $4.5 million in loans for a 34.5% ownership stake and a weekly TV show. Construction began July 1954, facing numerous challenges, including severe weather, labor strikes, and engineering problems. Admiral Joseph Fowler's expertise proved crucial for building codes, while landscaper Bill Evans creatively solved challenges using upturned orange trees as exotic vines for the jungle cruise. Disneyland's opening day, dubbed Black Sunday, saw overwhelming crowds of 28,000 guests, melting asphalt, and food shortages. However, the live television broadcast reached 90 million viewers, and Walt proudly dedicated the park as a source of joy and inspiration to all the world. Despite initial media criticism, Disneyland quickly proved successful, welcoming its millionth visitor by September 1955. Walt's perseverance paid off. By 1960, Disney bought back ABC's stake, and by 1961, all Bank of America loans were paid off, ending decades of debt. Walt Disney promised that Disneyland would never be completed, vowing to continuously expand and improve his park by absorbing new ideas and inspiration from everywhere. Rather than installing fences to keep guests off trampled grass near Sleeping Beauty's castle, Walt responded to a groundskeeper's concern by creating a pathway with a sign marking it as the best place for photographing the castle. This exemplified Walt's approach to improving Disneyland, observing and listening to people. He regularly walked the park, talking with guests and gathering ideas, opinions, and complaints. Cast members recall Walt's hands-on approach. If told something needed improvement, he would take immediate action, as when he quickly fixed a visible mechanical hippo in the Jungle Cruise after a staff member pointed it out. Walt often dressed in blue jeans and a straw hat to tour the park early mornings, speaking with employees and checking operations. He would even work behind the Carnation ice cream counter, scooping the biggest cones while asking guests about their experience. Walt encouraged his staff to similarly immerse themselves, telling them to stand in line with people, don't go off the lot to eat, eat at the park, and listen to people. Walt's belief that impossible was merely a challenge to overcome is perfectly illustrated by the Rainbow Caverns Mine Train attraction. When Walt wanted a glowing waterfall with separate fluorescent colors that wouldn't mix, imagine your clawed coats consulted experts who declared it impossible. Walt simply replied, "Well, Claude, you just haven't found the right idea yet." After numerous failed attempts, Coates and fellow Imagineer John Hench solved the problem using braided glass fibers in the water channels. Tom Sawyer Island, uniquely designed entirely by Walt himself, further demonstrates his receptiveness to ideas from unexpected sources. When 12-year-old newsboy Tom Nab boldly approached Walt about playing Tom Sawyer on the island, Walt eventually gave him the job. For 6 years, Nab portrayed Tom Sawyer, and Walt would regularly walk the island with him, soliciting the boy's suggestions for improvements. "He listened to people, even to kids," Nab recalled, "and he was always soliciting new ideas." Walt's genius for absorbing inspiration from his travels transformed Disneyland in 1959. While filming in Switzerland, Walt was struck by the Matterhorn and immediately sent a postcard to Imagineer Vic Green with the simple instruction, "Vic, build this. Walt." In Germany, he discovered the Allweg monorail technology. Despite his brother Roy's financial concerns, Walt seized the opportunity while Roy was away in Europe to begin construction on three major attractions, the Matterhorn, the monorail, and the submarine voyage. Walt constantly absorbed information and ideas from everywhere. Walt would walk into a room, throw out some ideas, and get a discussion going right away, composer Richard Sherman recalls. He wanted people to improve his ideas, saying, "Anyone can say, I don't like it. I want to hear you say, here's how we can make it better." Walt's collaborative approach turned their office into an idea factory. The storyboard, now a standard creative tool, was invented accidentally at the Hyperion Avenue studio in 1931 when artist Webb Smith began pinning drawings to boards to rearrange story sequences. Walt quickly recognized its revolutionary potential and insisted on storyboarding every project, cartoons, live-action films, and Disneyland attractions. Any Disney employee could post suggestions on the storyboards, and Walt personally read every idea. Through his constant absorption of knowledge, Walt became an expert in fields far beyond animation, including architecture and food service. Disney biographer Bob Thomas noted, "Walt was always thinking, reading, listening, working, gathering ideas. He lived and breathed ideas. To be like Walt, become a sponge for ideas. Keep your eyes and ears open, read, watch, travel, talk to people, ask questions, and invite opinions." Walt Disney was a walking paradox, the greatest nostalgist who ever lived, yet fascinated by the future. More importantly, Walt didn't just predict the future, he made it happen. Ray Bradbury's first meeting with Walt exemplified this forward-thinking spirit. When Bradbury asked to take Walt to lunch sometime soon, Walt immediately replied, "How about tomorrow?" From that moment, these two visionaries, both storytellers who lived half their lives in the future, became great friends. Walt's foresight about television's potential demonstrated his visionary thinking. When he discovered an unfamiliar word, television, in a contract that would have surrendered his TV rights to United Artists, something told him not to sign those rights away. While other Hollywood moguls feared television as competition, Walt embraced it as an ally. In 1950, Walt produced 1 Hour in Wonderland for NBC, viewed by 20 million people, despite only 10 million homes having TV sets. The Disneyland series, debuting in 1954, transformed Disney in three ways. It brilliantly promoted the theme park, generated massive merchandising opportunities like the $100 million Davy Crockett craze, and established Walt as Uncle Walt to American families. Walt resisted network pressure to follow trends, insisting on setting them instead. Through television, Walt multiplied his influence exponentially, embracing new technology where others feared it. Walt's vision extended to space exploration after Ward Kimball showed him a series of Collier's Magazine articles about space travel in 1953. These articles provided inspiration for Tomorrowland attractions and led to a meeting with rocket scientist Wernher von Braun. Both men, influenced by Jules Verne, believed science could improve human life and wanted to ignite public support for an American space program. When Kimball and writer Charles Schoes presented their script covering 1,000 years of rocketry through future space exploration, Walt recognized they had not one, but three stories. Man in Space, about rocket development; Tomorrow the Moon, about lunar missions; and Mars and Beyond, about the search for extraterrestrial life. The series proved enormously influential, with Man in Space attracting 42 million viewers in March 1955. President Eisenhower requested copies of all three episodes, and the series inspired thousands of young people to pursue careers in space science. Von Braun later told Kimball that NASA had followed their script for the Apollo moon landing almost 14 years later. Walt embodied a fascinating paradox: deeply nostalgic about the past, yet obsessed with tomorrow. He spent millions recreating his boyhood Main Street and historical American periods while simultaneously developing Tomorrowland with equal passion. As Imagineer John Hench noted, Walt had one foot in the past and one foot in the future. Tomorrowland required constant updating as the present caught up with yesterday's visions of tomorrow. Walt acknowledged this challenge, saying, "The minute we do Tomorrowland, it's today and past." After Sputnik and America's space program developments, he had to rebuild his original Tomorrowland to keep pace with reality. Walt built Tomorrowland not just as entertainment, but to inspire young people about humanity's future in space and a peaceful, harmonious world. Shortly before his death, Walt told Ron Miller, "If I could live for 15 more years, I would surpass everything I've done over the past 45 years." After Walt's passing, Tomorrowland evolved into a retro-futuristic nostalgia-land, perhaps solving the obsolescence problem, but losing the truly forward-looking vision Walt championed. To follow Walt's future-focused mindset, we must embrace change rather than fear it. Walt succeeded by quickly adopting new technologies like sound in films and television, while competitors hesitated. We should welcome new ideas and technologies as inevitable waves to ride into the future. As Walt showed, predicting the future isn't difficult. You simply make a prediction, then work to make it come true. In the late 1950s, Walt Disney focused on blending entertainment with education, starting with the Mickey Mouse Club. He appointed Bill Walsh as television producer and selected Jimmy Dodd, a devout Christian performer, as the Mouseketeers' leader. Roy Williams, the Big Mouseketeer, designed the iconic Mickey Mouse ears that sold 20,000 daily at the show's peak. Walt revolutionized casting by seeking ordinary kids with star quality from schools. The original Mouseketeers included Sharon Baird, Cubby O'Brien, Karen Pendleton, Lonnie Burr, Tommy Cole, Doreen Tracy, Darlene Gillespie, and Annette Funicello, whom Walt personally discovered. When Annette considered therapy for her shyness, Walt encouraged her natural personality, saying, "People love you just the way you are." The show emphasized education, featuring physicist Julius Sumner Miller as Professor Wonderful and Jiminy Cricket for safety segments. It was supported by the Disney Television Classroom Guide and the Mickey Mouse Club magazine to promote learning, with Walt insisting on talking up to young viewers rather than down. Walt's True Life Adventure series began after a dramatic 1947 Alaskan trip with his daughter Sharon, where their plane nearly crashed. Beginning with 1949's Seal Island, the series included films like The Living Desert and The African Lion, adding Disney's distinctive style to nature documentaries. These films influenced generations of environmentalists, including Card Walker's daughter, Mignon. In 1961, Walt established CalArts by merging the Los Angeles Conservatory of Music and Schoenard Art Institute. He considered this interdisciplinary arts institution his most important legacy, donating land and 45% of his estate to it. His friend Ray Bradbury noted, "Walt was a born teacher. Everything he did pointed to a moral or indicated a route for us to take." Walt's mentorship extended to individuals like Ken Wales, a high school senior whom he guided through the studio and supported with a USC scholarship. Wales later became a successful filmmaker and USC professor, embodying Walt's commitment to nurturing future generations.